We're back on the record, and it is the PCA Citizens Board meeting on Tuesday, August 25th, 6th. 26th, my apologies. We're still on the subject. The decision item related to the Riverview LLP Baker Dairy Feedlot, and we are the staff has come back and has some additional information. To start us off, Mr. Craig Affelt would like to lead off with some discussion. Mr. Affelt.
I'm Craig Affelt. I'm the supervisor of environmental review at Pollution Control Agency. I just wanted to review quickly what we're going to bring back in terms of information we put together over the break. And George Schwint is going to, he's put together a new map. He's going to go over that in terms of what the other Riverview facilities are in that broader area. Charles Peterson will review the air quality modeling that was done, I guess focusing primarily on hydrogen sulfide. We'll turn it back to George then, who will talk a bit more about the background about how what governs manure applications in terms of nitrogen and phosphorus, what role they play in that that part of the project. Mr. Peterson will review the groundwater situation in terms of the prior environmental review and permitting of the water supply that's proposed. Mr. Schwint will then say a bit more about the permitting situation of other facilities. How is it that a facility that was permitted a few years ago, is that how does it retain a valid permit? And then I would come back to what some of the options are for board members to consider as far as EQB rules go. So,
great. Thank you, Mr. Affelt. So, Mr. Schwint, you're up with your map first.
Commissioner Stein and board members, I'm going to apologize for the crudeness of the map here. I did it in about 15 minutes, so excuse the unofficial-looking map, but it's a map of the area around Baker Dairy. And you can see there all the dairies are labeled that Riverview has a part of or is ownership of. Baker Dairy there on the left-hand side by the County Road 8 sign there, be about where it'd be located. You go to the east, you get West River Dairy, and the permit for that one right now is 9,998 animal units, so just under 10,000 animal units. Keep traveling west, you end up towards Riverview Dairy. That's 9,300 animal units.
East.
East, yes. Then head straight south from Riverview. You'll run in the District 45, which is 10,500 approximately animal units. And then the calf site is located nearby District 45, and that's 1,698 animal units.
Mr. Jensen has a question.
Commissioner, Mr. Swint, I was really kind of interested in the total number of concentrated animal operations in the area.
Mr. Schwein?
Commissioner Stein and Member Jensen. So these little dots are on the map here. The blue ones are all concentrated animal feeding operations that we permit. So NPDS permitted facilities, the little blue dots. The little green dots are all the other facilities that are underneath that threshold to get a permit. So that gives you an overall idea of the density of feedlots in that area. I don't have any specific information on each one has so many animal units, but that's the overall density. So the larger ones are the little blue dots and the smaller ones are little green dots.
Thank you. Any other questions? Dr. Foley.
So when we do air quality monitoring, we monitor at specific facilities or we model at a specific facility around. How do we take into account all those dots in different areas? Because that's not that many miles. And it's thousands of animal units.
Roll ahead, Mr. Peterson, and talk about your air quality modeling.
Okay. Yes. Commissioner Stein, Board Member Foley. When any feedlot comes in for environmental review, we require that they do air quality modeling for hydrogen sulfide, for ammonia, and for odor. They're required to submit a protocol, which gets reviewed and approved. Occasionally, we suggest changes. In fact, I believe on this one, I rejected the first one and required them to come back with the second one before I approved it. The modeling takes into account a five-year period. We have meteorological data. Our air modeling unit pre-processes meteorological data for five-year periods for a number of sites around the state. They plug that in. The model uses a conservative approach. For nearby sources, we have to use nearby sources and a background value. For nearby sources, we use that it's a 3 mile by 3 mile grid. That's where the feedlot in question is in that, we put that in that center section. And then any feedlots or any other nearby sources that may be emitting hydrogen sulfide or ammonia or odor in that area, we would include as a nearby source. So we would have specific emission rates and specific emission values for that. Because we don't necessarily have specific information on everything, we then include for hydrogen sulfide specifically a 17 parts per billion background value, which is a little bit more than 50% of the standard, which is 30 parts per billion. And that 17 parts per billion is to account for all those other sources that we don't necessarily have that specific information. The 17 parts per billion is an extremely conservative value that was developed and put together following a process by our air modeling unit, and that's the standard that we've been using for a number of years when we do this air modeling.
Dr. Foley.
So when you use the word conservative model, you mean that the number that you've chosen is taken into account the uncertainty factor that you have not having those specific numbers. So by applying that, it gives kind of a margin of safety for how you would plug that number into the model.
Correct. That is correct. The model that is used that we require them to use now is AirMod. In the past, we had let them use CalPUF, which is also an EPA-approved model. AirMod is an EPA-approved model. It was developed by the EPA for doing air dispersion modeling. And we'd like to point out that for this proposal, they are using the best available air control technology that we have for feedlots at this time.
Mr. Riddle.
Do you do actual monitoring besides just this modeling?
Mr. Peterson.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle. In the feedlot program, modeling or monitoring is typically done on a complaint basis, where if somebody submits an odor complaint, we will go out, the program will go out and do monitoring using a continuous air monitor during the active season, which is usually April through about September. We have not specifically gone out and done it on a site which has gone through environmental review at this time. And again, it's generally done on a complaint basis. If somebody complains or we have enough complaints on a site, then they will go out and we will deploy the monitors. And George might be able to address that a little bit more detail than I just did.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in how those results compare to your modeling and if it validates the modeling or if it shows there's some problems.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson or Mr. Schwinn?
Again, I don't know that we haven't specifically gone back and modeled a site that's gone through environmental review. Back in my days when I worked in the feedlot program, I was involved with a number of them that did do the monitoring. And typically what we found are sites that have the open basins, open manure basins, are the ones where we have issues. And as a result of that, actually, swine manure, you cannot have an open manure basin anymore. It has to have some kind of a cover on it, or it's got to be beneath the barn. I don't know if that's helping you out a little bit, but...
And might I just interject? I know that the agency dealt with feedlot issue at Valadco up in northwestern...
Correct.
Minnesota?
No, that would be Renville County.
Renville County
facility.
So maybe we...
The one you're thinking of, the most recent one.
Excel is the one, yes. In northwestern Minnesota. Okay, I'm sorry. So Valadco, talk a little bit about our experience. I don't know, George, if you recall that we did some field monitoring at that facility, I'm told, by Dr. Foley, our resident historian.
And Dr. Foley predates me, so that was in the year 2000 or so, I want to say, is when the Valadco facility was being monitored. I don't recall if we did modeling in conjunction with monitoring, But the monitoring we did was a continuous air monitor at the property line, showed exceedances. That facility has now eliminated the major problem and covered the rest with the impermeable cover. And actually, in the XL Dairy case, that's what we were asking XL Dairy to do, to eliminate their emissions, was to cover the basins with a plastic cover. So that is the best technology that's out there for minimizing emissions from a facility, is covering the liquid manure storage areas.
Thank you. Mr. Riddle.
Well, looking at that map then with the Riverview's facilities, I mean, we heard from neighbors of West River that there are, you know, they're experiencing odor issues. And is that covered storage lagoons there?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein and Member Riddle. Yes, all the facilities have HDPE plastic covers on their basins at Riverview.
Okay.
Dr. Drager.
So getting back to what triggers you to collect the data that would then go back and validate the model, you probably don't have any models that you generated for any of the existing facilities, but does that kind of constitute a complaint that you would then start collecting data on?
Schwint.
Commissioner Stein and Member Drager, the decision to put a CAM and monitor a site is done by the program as a whole. We have limited access to CAMs and limited staff to run those CAMs and gather the data. So I can't speak on if that constitutes a complaint that we then put a CAM at Riverview Dairy or if we put one at District 45 or wherever, but that would be one of the criteria that's used at looking at when placing CAMs is number of complaints and what the facility has for control technologies at this time.
Cool. Mr. Ibarra.
So if the storage basins are already covered, what options are there for reducing or eliminating the odor?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein and Member Barra, like I said, that is the best technology that's out there for eliminating the odors, and emissions from hydrogen sulfide are covers. That's the Cadillac system that I know of. I don't know of anything else that they could be doing to eliminate odors.
So the only other option would be to reduce animal units?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein and board members, the only other solution is to not have the storage in the first place. Yeah. That's it.
Mr. Jensen, and then Dr. Foley.
Mr. Schwint. The reality is you're never going to be able to completely eliminate, you know, the smell of a dairy. I mean, you can do everything, you know, within the latest technology to try to diminish it. And my concern, and it relates to one of the criteria in the EAW, which is the cumulative potential effects. And I'm looking at this map, and I'm seeing a concentration of concentrated animal feedlots. And that causes me great concern, because knowing that that there is going to be a residual odor out there, regardless of how much effort put into containing it, you're not going to get it all. And that's a single unit. When you add the number of these operations within a very limited area, it doesn't matter where you live, you're going to be impacted by that because it's all going to add up. It's going to increase, proportionally to the number of permits or the operations that are in this area. So I guess I have great concern about adding one more operation into this very small area without looking further at, what's going to happen, what the cumulative effect is going to be.
Mr. Peterson, Mr. Affelt?
Craig Affelt. I guess I would, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jensen, a cumulative effects analysis has several components, but the first component is to look at or identify all the past, present, and future projects in a project area. And so we have done that in this case. The past projects that you see on the map there would be basically every feedlot that we're aware of in that project area. We've accounted for those using a conservative background number for hydrogen sulfide. So by building that as an input into the model, we feel we've adequately and conservatively represented all the current combined effects from those feedlots as far as hydrogen sulfide is concerned. Superimposing on that would be any additional facilities in that project area that are big enough. We add those into our model. In this case, there aren't any within our modeling grid that we use to, you know, it's a relevant area to model. And then we add in the anticipated impacts from the proposal, and then as an input into the model. And by the way, that includes all the sources at the facility, not just two manure basins. It would include every identifiable odor source at that facility, and it would be accompanied by an estimated emission rates for various constituents that we're looking at. So we think we've accounted for everything in the model. We use an off-the-shelf model, but it is a sophisticated model, and it's the one that we've gone to over the last few years, and we feel it's the best way to do the model. We feel we give a conservative result for that. We feel it's protective, and compare that to the standard. And if they fall below the standard, they're given the go-ahead there, and because we haven't modeled a non-compliance situation. As far as we think that that's a more conservative scenario than monitoring is, because monitoring is at best it's kind of, you know, you might monitor 1 year and so on, but a modeling exercise is based on a series of worst case or conservative assumptions to try to pick that point in time where maybe over a few hours, over a five-year period, they actually might exceed the standard. We didn't find that in this case. That's why we're comfortable that we've looked at cumulative effects.
Mr. Jensen has a follow-up, and then we'll go to Dr. Foley. Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Mr. Alfer, one of the things that was brought out that the original permits have been greatly expanded, that they've added animal units to each operation. Was that also modeled within this permit application? Did you look at, you're looking at the current permit for 9,000, I think, animal units, but the potential exists for them expanding that every 3 years, I understand. And what would that impact then be looked at?
Mr. Peterson.
Commissioner Stein, Member Jensen. Again, the modeling domain, when we look at the modeling, only goes out so far, because that's we can show that the effects of the air dispersion really only goes out so far, and from those individual sites only goes so far. So that's really the reason we only go out that 3 mile by 3 mile grid, really only about a mile and a half from the site. The only time that air modeling gets done on a feedlot facility is when they go through the environmental review process. So unless the expansion had triggered a new EAW, we would not look at that air modeling. If they did do the air modeling, we would look at the totality of that facility, you know, everything that's in that facility and anything, that, again, that's around that facility, and take all of that into consideration. But again, the air modeling at feedlots is triggered by the need to do an EAW.
Dr. Foley.
So we have an experience as an agency with these folks who build these dairies and operate them on this scale, because they have five facilities in Minnesota. I think I gleaned from the document that the West River facility is similar in size and kind of the proposed construction that this proposal that we're discussing today is. So just refresh our memories on, because I don't want to, this is not XL Dairy here. These are not the XL Dairy people who tried to do everything wrong and succeeded. But we have a successful operator who has a track record with us. So talk to us about their ability to operate the West River, which is a good and close example to what this proposal is.
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein and board members, the West River facility is very similar, and their track record with the agency has been very good. They have one enforcement action that we've taken, not against West River, but another site in Swift County, the East Dublin Dairy, and that was related to burning solid waste. So we don't have any violations or any enforcement actions on manure-related spills or overflows or over-application. Their track record has been very good with us. And what was the second part of your question?
Okay, so, George, if they have covered lagoons there, what's the effectiveness of those covered lagoons, and are you getting complaints by people in that area on odors, et cetera, on how they operate the facility?
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Foley. When the EAW was going out on notice, I searched our complaint database, and that's not a comprehensive listing of all complaints we ever get, but any complaints we get should be logged in this complaint database, and I didn't see any complaints for odors or air emissions. Not saying that there may not be some odors or emissions, like Member Jensen said, you can't capture everything. You can do what you can with the manure storage base, and that's the biggest bang for the buck. But I didn't see any odor complaints or any complaints of H2S violations of the sort.
So, Mr. Chairman, so
Dr. Foley,
based upon the proposed engineering and based upon the actual engineering at West River, this seems to, they're proposing a state-of-the-art 9,000-plus animal unit dairy farm and manure operation. That there isn't any other magical thing that they haven't proposed to put in place that exists.
Mr. Schwint.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Foley, not that I'm aware of, that would be state-of-the-art facility that we have in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Mr. Riddle.
Got it.
Okay. Dr. Drager.
So just one other landscape kind of level observations that we're seeing a great deal of pattern tiling. And I was wondering if that's taken into account in any of these manure application scenarios as well.
So, Mr. Schwint, why don't you talk about the manure application conversation you were going to launch into about nitrogen and phosphorus and deal with that question at the same time.
Okay. Commissioner Stein and board members, I went back and looked at the manure management plan over the break and what they have submitted to us and we've approved as far as it's a nitrogen-based plan, but also really looks at phosphorus. Looking at the application rates they have proposed in the plan that we approved, they're going to be short on phosphorus what the crop actually needs. They're going to be about 20 pounds short for a corn crop. So they have an effect, even though they don't really advertise that they have a phosphorus-based plan. They're doing what they can for phosphorus. They're only applying what the crop needs. So that addresses the phosphorus issue. The tile issue and pattern tile issue, I don't have a great answer for you. They are doing injection, which puts it at the root level for the crops to use. Yes, spring application would be preferred versus fall application. But there are some issues with spring application as far as crop growth as well. You don't want compaction in your soils. And the spring, you want to get your crop in as soon as you can. So that delays planting the crop if you do spring application. It's preferable, but fall application is the next best thing. And the pattern tile issue, we don't have any setbacks to pattern tile. Our setbacks are related to open tile intakes, which is the pipe coming out of the ground. And that is 300 foot for non-incorporated manure. If you inject it, there is no setback.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, you were going to talk about the groundwater supply analysis and some of the issues. Oh, sorry.
I had a question.
Go ahead, Mr.
on
Riddle.
This
yep.
Nutrient management, yep. Specifically related to the impaired waters. As I had read, there's impairments for phosphorus, eutrophication, E. coli, other impairments in that watershed. And it says in our materials, page 8, item 46, that the MPCA must conduct studies to identify and assess the sources of phosphorus in the watershed and determine appropriate TMDLs, et cetera. Has that been done? Or would that be done as part of an EIS?
Mr. Affelt.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Stein, board members. I'd like to start answering that in a general sense, and then maybe Chuck can just review currently what's going on in the Palm Du Terre River watershed, because I've spent 7 years in basin work and watershed as TMDL project manager, and recognize that the listing and assessment and study and implementation phases of these projects are journeys. They're not things that happen overnight. So, but there's been an extensive work that's already been done in the Pomme de Terre watershed, and things are being addressed generally on a watershed basis. We try to do our assessments now at the agency on a 10-year cycle where major river basins are assessed on a and revisited on a 10-year plan. But the work itself on a TMDL is, you know, the waters within that area have been assessed. The studies have been done. TMDL reports have been done. Some total maximum daily loads that address stressors for some of those impairments have been done. And the work, so it's an ongoing process to develop that. While that is occurring, projects come before you for permitting, before the agency. And they are addressed on a case-by-case basis, but they should be, and in this case it was reviewed in terms of, are there potential conflicts that arise with what's being proposed now that's heading in a different direction than the TMDL work that's being done. So we do try to maintain that bridge so we reflect the information in the TMDL work and impose that on the project. We haven't identified areas of the project that conflict with so far findings as they've been developed in the TMDL process. And maybe, Mr. Peterson, if you can just go into the current status, because there was a report that just came out.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle. There was originally a TMDL done specifically for the Pomme de Terre River, and that's been in place for a while. In this project, we looked at that, and the project is consistent with the implementation plan of that. In addition, there's a number of other impairments that people have alluded to, and they will be covered in this Pomme de Terre River watershed TMDL. It's taken into consideration the entire TMDL. The report has been written and approved, and they are currently the actual TMDL report. It's a draft one right now, is actually currently on notice and receiving public comment right now. I believe it went on notice about August 18th and will be coming off notice in September. I've looked at the draft implementation plan for that, and at this point that it is consistent with, this project is consistent with that implementation plan.
Mr. Riddle.
Well, it just seems, looking at that map, there's certainly already a lot of CAFO, so it's not surprising that the water is impaired in that watershed already. And now what I'm hearing is you're okay with adding to it, that this project won't make things worse, in your opinion. But things are already bad.
Correct. And the reason we don't think that it's going to make it any worse is because of exactly what George alluded to. The phosphorus is the main thing that we'd be concerned about in terms of eutrophication of lakes and nutrient loading. And the manure will be a replacement for that phosphorus. There will be no additional phosphorus added into the watershed as a result of this project.
Question for Mr. Schwint. I just want to explore that a little bit further. Did your comment regarding phosphorus, that they're short, that they're actually technically short on their phosphorus load, could it be inferred that a farmer might agronomically apply additional phosphorus from a commercial fertilizer to meet that load? What did you mean? You kind of left that hanging out there, that they're going to be a little short on phosphorus.
Commissioner Stein, the application rate that they proposed for most fields is going to provide roughly 50 pounds of phosphorus for the crop. A growing corn crop will use about 76 pounds of phosphorus. That's what it uses. Now it can mine some from the soil. So if the soil tests soil has natural phosphorus, it can mine that as well. But if it's available in the manure, it'll use it from manure. Mm-hmm. So in theory, they maybe could apply some commercial fertilizer. It's not going to be a large amount, but it is possible they could have to even add more phosphorus to the to the crop.
And so I asked that question, Mr. Riddle, on the premise that what's regulated as an activity and what's unregulated as an activity. The application of commercial fertilizer on corn crops is an unregulated activity other than the label for the for anything that's a fertilizer or pesticide is the regulation, of course, and applying it up to that agronomic rate is what's recommended but not unregulated. So I don't know. I just put that out there for the discussion.
But yet you have impairments for phosphorus and eutrophication, which is also directly related to excess phosphorus. So there's excess phosphorus in the water. You have evidence of that. So where do you attribute that coming from, if not from the CAFOs?
Mr. Schwint.
Mr. Stein and Member Riddle, as we stated, there's commercial application of phosphorus too, and that is unregulated. And there is no restriction on how much phosphorus they can apply to their crops. They can apply what they want for commercial fertilizer. Here we do have the NPDES permit, and we have a mineral management plan that we can point to and say this is the application rate. They're not putting on extra phosphorus in this particular field. Maybe they were before the commercial fertilizer. Maybe this will offset some of that. Without monitoring each individual field and each individual tile outlet, there's no way to quantify is it coming off from commercial fertilizer, coming from animal agriculture. That's a very broad discussion.
We do know sources of nitrates. We did a fairly thorough analysis statewide of the sources of nitrates in our water systems, and we know that a significant share of what's found is from agricultural infiltration and tile as a pathway, and also groundwater is shallow groundwater is pathway. So presumably that's what you're thinking, is that all those sources, all those agricultural sources are potential sort of contributor to the phosphorus that's out there in the water system. And I see Mr. Affelt is digging through the TMDL report, probably looking for the phosphorus attribution.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I found what I was hoping to find there, which is what the allocation of sources would be in terms of reductions needed to meet the TMDL. The report does have there are total maximum daily loads for these waters, Lake Hattie, and there's other lakes and somewhere else in the Pomme de Terre Basin. So there are TMDLs that I've had in the draft report. So those will be established. Those will be the targets that we'll seek to attain in order to restore the water quality, restore those uses of the lakes. I don't know what the allocation is, but there is, as you probably know, within a TMDL process, both the point and the non-point sources, the waste loads and the other load allocations are given, divided up within the watershed among the various sources, and each one has its own targets for reduction. So I can't speak to, this is a draft report now as well, but the goal is there. The goal is to reach whatever the total maximum daily load that's established for phosphorus for those lakes. And you know, the proof will come over a period of years, obviously, as hopefully first with the waste loads will be brought in under control, if they're not controlled already, to the level they need be. And then the same thing has to be done in the non-point world as well, which goes far beyond this feedlot and would cover all potential non-point sources.
Let's continue in the discussion of the groundwater the water supply issues. I think, Mr. Peterson, you were going to cover that.
Correct. Commissioner Stein, when we were looking at the groundwater issue and when they switched sources of water over to the APEC well, what we looked at was there going to be a significant change in the circumstances as it relates to that permit? And our conclusion was that there would be no change in the circumstances which would invalidate the findings of that EAW which was completed for the ethanol plant. And as a result, we chose to stand on the findings of that EAW in terms of making our analysis of the groundwater.
I also recall Mr. Frischman's statement earlier that we do not have any observation well data in the period of time that's occurred since the well was constructed, the test pumping occurred, and now. So there isn't like an opportunity to review that intervening period of time's data to determine whether there's reason to change that conclusion, I guess, or question the conclusion. Is that your understanding, Mr. Peterson?
Commissioner Stein, that is correct.
Dr. Foley.
Well, didn't we also hear from the DNR relative to that?
Yes, and that Mr. Frischman is from the DNR, and his point, as I understand it, was that there's insufficient data to conclude that the original pump test values showed sufficient cause, and he's going to come forward and offer more. That's good. So, Jay, if you can just help us recall that conversation about the EAW that was done on the ethanol facility and sort of presumptions about water supply and groundwater impacts and your current assessment of water supply conditions.
Commissioner Stein, Dr. Foley, that is correct. At this point, obviously it would have been nice to have that data. We always try to use all sources available to us. But because we don't have that, we just have not got a new source to change that opinion at this point.
Dr. Foley.
Jay, generally for the DNR, how when you analyze these kind of appropriation permits, how long is that analysis good for? Are there factors that change? Because I was somewhat shocked at the end of the presentation of the proposer that they're thinking not of building it, and yet they've contracted for water, and of course we're here debating as if it's going to be built. And so how long is your analysis relative to water availability, appropriation, et cetera, good for in your mind? Do you have a rule of thumb? Or?
Commissioner Stein, Dr. Foley, no, there is no set statute or even in our mind how long an analysis may last for. If the situation changes, the geology is going to remain static. Our understanding of the geology doesn't remain static. If new wells go in near this facility, we may find something out. The testing that's going on may completely change our understanding of how things are working. The Pomme de Terre River, for instance, we're seeing over time that flows are changing because of land use, or usually attributed to land use, whether it's croppage or we've clear cut or done something. So obviously kind of resets some of our understanding. In the case of this appropriation, sadly, I have to sit here and tell you, I was in anticipation that I'd have 5 years of data to look at when we received notification that this permit amendment had come into place. That wasn't to be. Now, generally, in the Pomme de Terre, I can tell you that it is one of the areas of concern that we've identified. We are going to be putting additional resources into monitoring that DNR will be installing wells. We're going to be installing additional gauging sites in there, just as a number of other locations across the state. But that's partly just a function of that recognizing that things are changing and available resources in responding to that.
Okay. Dr. Drager and then Mr. Riddle, and then I have a question for you too, Jay, while you're here. Dr. Drager.
So you said that you're going to be putting some additional monitoring or attention to the Pomme de Terre. For what purpose and what resource is changing?
Mr. Frischman.
Commissioner Stein, Dr. Drager. The additional resources, the legislature provided the DNR with additional funding last year so that we could expand our observation well network. We maintain and have maintained over the last 20-some years, about 2,000 wells, of which 700, 800 of those are actively read. And depending on the resources available, as in just the bodies being able to measure it. So that's the resources, one way I can answer that. The other is that the Pontotera is being identified as a source of potential concern, only in that the U.S. Geological Survey had done a model of the water availability for that overall system in 1988, and Jeff Deline, who was the researcher at the time, identified, felt that we may be reaching the upper limit of the appropriation that that system could sustain long term. Now, they put in a number of wells during that study. The problem with when the U.S. Geological Survey puts in wells, they have a design life of 2 years. It's kind of like sending the Mars rover up. We're going to design it for 6 months, and then you hopefully get an extra few years out of it. A lot of the wells that went into the Pomme de Terre during the study in 1988 had that two-year design life because that's what their funding cycle was. So we have wells there that pretty much should have given up life 10 years ago that we're still monitoring. They're in connection with the aquifer, but not the way we would like to be. So my staff has been tasked with the job of identifying, A, where should we add new wells? Our monitoring unit is dealing with replacement stuff. My folks are looking at new areas that we would put those resources in, and that's the resource discussion that why the Pomme de Terre has come to our light, regardless of the appropriation here.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, well, Dr. Drager and others have talked about extreme weather events and in the context of heavy rains, but the flip side of that is drought, and which we experience one or the other, it seems. And I know statewide there have been a lot more irrigation wells put in the last 5 years, some of them regulated, many unregulated. And I'm just wondering if you have any data on the number of irrigation wells that have been put in Stevens County or in that area. You know, does anybody have a handle on how much water is already being drawn? And then the other side, you know, beyond that is, you know, we heard from the proposers that, you know, when their cows need water, they have to be watered. So the irrigators all of a sudden are a little lower priority than keeping a cow alive. So just wondering, you know, if anybody has a handle on what's going on just in the last 5 years with irrigation especially.
Mr. Frischman.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle. Yes, those numbers are available. I don't have them off the top of my head. In general, to address a couple of your points, there was a lot of news coverage last year about unpermitted irrigators in areas of the state. Part of that additional resources that I referred to, the additional funding that the legislature gives, was to track those folks down. DNR staff have been added, and through a process of using like air photos, Google Earth is definitely the eye in the sky that's very up to date. Based upon a lot of work that a number of folks put in over the last couple of years, we've identified a significant number of folks who have been operating illegally over the years. They are coming under, you know, permit. So technically, they are going to be regulated. Historically, maybe not. Those numbers, part of the actual volume, they are supposed to, an irrigator or any appropriator is supposed to report at the end of the year what their water usage. Earlier I mentioned the zero reported usage by APEC. That's if they didn't build a plan, one would assume they had a zero usage. You still have to report that so that we can at least track those, what the rate and volume is that's being appropriate in an area. The numbers, just the way that things, and I have to speak historically where I have dabbled in this, the best numbers are usually several years behind. So our best reported numbers might be, say, 2012. However, we're not going to have those unpermitted folks accounted for until probably moving forward. So I hope I'm not dodging your question, but that's just how things are reported in. Unfortunately, and folks always point this out, well, you're entrusting that appropriator to give you the numbers. We do not have any way of knowing exactly what it is that they're taking. So we do require, we require them to report. There are a number of different methods to do that, but it is a good faith reporting system that we rely on.
Would it be safe to say that things have changed quite a bit in the 5 years since the APEC permit was issued as far as water drawdown in that particular aquifer?
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle. I'm going to have to answer just across the board. We have seen an increase in appropriation, of especially ag-related appropriation, in the last couple of years. So by default, I'll go to a yes.
Mr. Frischman, my question is, describe for me the hydrogeology of the system. How does the water move? You've got a permit, a water appropriation permit that sounds kind of unique. It's tied to stream flow in the Palme de Terre, and so there must be some concern about the connection between the aquifer that this well is drawing from and flow in the river. And can you just describe generally the hydrogeology and the relationships that led you to do that in the permit?
Commissioner Stein, the initial testing, as I mentioned before, this was not a project I worked on, so I'm drawing from what I could glean out of the report. But first of all, the Palme de Terre sands are essentially a glacial outwash that when the glaciers retreated, flowed off, and just as you see now, higher velocity has more coarse materials. The coarser of the material, i.e. sand and gravel, the better aquifer it is. Many of the riverine systems in western Minnesota, the Palme de Terre, the Chippewa River, actually sit in those sands and gravels. So when someone comes in and drills a well in those riverine systems or in that sand and gravel, by nature, it's going to be connected somehow to the river. Now, depending on a whole myriad of things, and I'm going to keep this brief. John knows how I can drag this on. Commissioner Stein.
It's all right.
The long and short of it is that distance is our greatest ally to minimize the drawdown effect on a feature. So the greater the distance, the less drawdown you would anticipate on some sort of a feature, in this case the river. Now, I'm going to speculate here that the wells went in to this system because of the connection. The sands and gravels that were there make for a great aquifer. You can produce 1,000 GPM out of this well. The other side of that equation is the river system and the aquifer system, which interact together, bring water in to that well site, but also the whole aquifer system itself. So to get to the connection here is that apparently when they conducted this aquifer test, the conclusion was that the drawdown from that well at the pumping rate they did, which I'm assuming it was the permitted volume of 1,000 GPM, that they saw drawdown in observation wells adjacent to that river. The conclusion, therefore, is that they're going to draw some water from that river. Now, the permit condition that I mentioned before, where they are tying a operational plan to the flow in the river, is very unique. I'm not aware of this anywhere else in our in DNR system right now. We are trying to do conjunctive use, which is utilizing surface groundwater only in a little bit different context. Normally we'd say, we'd love to see you take from the river during high flows, and then you have to go, say, to groundwater when the flow drops to a certain level in the stream. In this case, they, by default, included that kind of a concept by saying, look, we have this gauge downstream in Appleton. It's a continuous gauge. Based upon, or at 8 a.m. every morning, you need to go take a look at the flows and adjust your operational plan accordingly. Their APEC actually has two permits for two wells. There's a north well field and a south well field, single wells in each. And over the break, I went and did a little more research. The well that we're talking about here is the southern well, and both north and south have connections to the river. The greatest problem with the northern well that I was able to glean, is there a whole load of domestic wells nearby that they had real high concerns for. So, yes, there, and in fact, in the permit, it specifically says all well interference regulations and rules are at play no matter what the operational plan is. So, you know, I don't, as I mentioned before, I don't know what kind of conversation went on between IPIC and Baker Dairy, but of the two wells, it looks like this made more sense just because you didn't have to deal with the well interference stuff.
Thank you. The let's move on to the permitting.
Commissioner?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Jensen.
While we have the DNR gentleman here, I was looking at the panel showing the path of the proposed pipeline, and it appears that in panel 5A, there's actually another receiver of that pipeline. Is the Baker Dairy the only authorized user of that pipeline?
I'm afraid I can't answer that.
Charles, do you know?
On the permit, they are the specific authorized agent besides APEC LLC, but the pipeline, I'm afraid I'd have to defer to other folks.
Mr. Peterson, do you know the answer, or maybe we can just...
May have to ask the project proposers for specifics, but my understanding is it's going to go right past the West River Dairy site, but to my knowledge, they're not going to be using any of this water for the West River Dairy site, but I think you should ask the project proposer that question.
Mr. Ferry, you want to just come up and answer it? Thank you. Just make sure we're all looking at the same thing, okay? Thank you, Mr. Fear.
Yep. Is what you're referring to, you'll see it says it's a pigging station, and is what that is, that's a spot to clean out the pipe. So you can actually insert a pig. It's called a pig. It's a big foam ball and push air behind it and pressure. You can clean the line. You can also pressure check the line.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure. So there's no plans to serve other users off of this pipeline?
No. If we would, we would have to get it cleared with them.
Okay. Thank you. Does that answer your question, Mr. Jensen? Okay. Others? Let's move on to Charles. You were going to talk, or George is going to talk about the permitting sort of and how that will, what that means.
All right. Commissioner Stein, I'll talk about the NPDES permit and the application period length of the permit. The permit that we have right now that they're applying for is a general feedlot NPDES permit. That permit has a set five-year term. 5 years. It's a set 5 years. Right now it's started in 2011 and runs till 2016. So at that point, we then develop a new general permit and public notice that and take comments on that, and then they can reapply for that permit. So the permit they're applying for now expires in 2016, and they'll be reapplying in 2015. So next year they'll be reapplying for permit coverage again for this site. And then that'll be underneath the new general NPDES permit. So they're set 5 year terms. So you don't get a full 5 years out of your permit usually. You get 1, 2, 3, depending upon when you apply in that permit cycle. That helps understand the general permit concept.
Mr. Schwint, if I could ask too, just is it common that we, or maybe Mr. Peterson, this is a question for you on environmental review, that we go through environmental review processes and then facilities don't get built immediately? How common or uncommon is that? Mr. Affel.
Well, I'll just address that one. There is a provision in the rules, fortunately, it's that explains what the reaction of a responsible governmental unit should be if a negative declaration were issued, that is, environmental review is done. But before the project is implemented, if there's a change in the circumstances, if something changes about the project, the RGU should make an evaluation of the change and determine if there are any impacts associated with that potentially that were not addressed in the original EAW or environmental review. So, and in fact, that's what essentially what has occurred here with respect to the well, the water usage question, where we really haven't identified any change which would prompt us to go back and feel, well, there was some impact here that wasn't really addressed properly in the first environmental review.
Understood.
So there is really no shelf life on an environmental review as long as the circumstances are essentially unchanged.
Dr. Foley.
Yeah, I think back to when we did the generic environmental impact statement on the forest products when they were going to build the Deerwood, what was it, a wood board plant press or board. Something, yep. Press board. And one of the things we talked about is, well, how long is an environmental analysis as in-depth as that one was good for, and could it, in how long will that be able to be utilized by individual projects that were using wood in that particular area? Now, my own recollection was that we, even though it's not in state statute, we figured that it probably has a 5-year lifespan. And as I think about and we heard that the proposer's not going to, at least at this time, build the plant, but has an expectation that if we pass a negative declaration that the environmental review then is complete, and if they come back and want to get the permit and build it and operate it, and then they also hold two other permits on unbuilt facilities. So how long is that environmental review for those two facilities good for? Is there something material that has to trigger that we reset the clock and start to look at environmental review again? Or is it they can just wait and then decide when they want to build it based upon an analysis done a number of years ago? Can you speak to that, please?
Yep.
Yes, Mr. Chair, board members. Again, it goes down. It is solely up to the RGU to determine whether the change that occurred since the environmental review but before implementation of a project, whether that's a significant change, whether it's substantial enough, whether the impacts associated with that are great enough so that the environmental review should go back and be redone. That was one of the issues, as you mentioned, in generic EIS. That was one of the issues in the case that was brought in that situation. Plaintiffs argued that it was too out of date, that the timber projections were invalid because it was too old. And in fact, part of that process involved Environmental Quality Board addressing that very issue. They, in a deliberate manner, addressed whether or not the generic EIS conclusions were still sufficiently valid so that they could be used in the, in that case, was the Boise Cascade. And they determined that it was acceptable. Certainly it was, you know, maybe a little ragged around the edges in certain places, but they determined as a board in a public session that it was still acceptable for use in that case. Not too long after that, a few years after that, they did go back and then updated the timber projections and so on. So again, it's a discretionary matter for the Pollution Control Agency here to decide there's something different here. We should go, you know, that creates uncertainty as to whether that environmental review is still valid, and you could require that to go back. Thus far, we haven't identified those kinds of circumstances. We see it as a situation where the original plan had some flaws in it or was perhaps less desirable than the plan that's now being used. So, but an additional pipeline capacity has to be built for this water main. Part of it would be the main that was used or described in the AW, but there's some additional length that it would have to be addressed as well. We look on that as essentially being the same types of impacts that we've addressed through the first segment. And so we don't see additional types of impacts that go beyond what we've already reviewed thus far. So, but again, it's the short answer to the question, the RGU, you know, with sufficient evidence, can go back and do that, redo that review.
Dr. Drager.
My opinion.
And that discretion of the RGU, that doesn't necessarily mean it comes back to this body or this board. That discretion could be handled at the staff level. That would come back to this board?
Mr. Affeld.
That's what the staff has done. Yep. We have, you know, we've looked at the, you know, and discussed this at length with DNR and had their input. They, you know, we've had this type of discussion. So we feel we've had done that part of it. And we're weighing the situation overall. We're looking at the net effect of the original proposal versus where we are now. So we actually think it's in a better place now. That's the staff opinion. But, you know, again, it all depends on what other additional evidence might come out or how you might see it.
Mr. Riddle. Oh, I'm sorry, Dr.
No, I was just following up on Dr. Foley's question where he said that this could be dormant for a period of time. And then at what point would you say that data holds true? And my question would be, if we had approved this at the EAW stage today and it was dormant for 5 years, whose discretion would it be that that was still a valid EAW if it's 5 years down the road? And that, so I was just trying to get to that question. Is that the board's discretion after we've approved it? If we approved that EAW today, then is it at the board's discretion if there's a dormant period for 5 years and then it's reactivated, or is that just the staff's discretion and then we would not have a chance to weigh in on if there's any other information or data or considerations?
Mr. Affeld.
Well, ultimately, it is the board. As the pollution control agency, you would have the discretion to, you know, make whatever decision you felt was supported by the evidence. How that would come about in a case like this is also, you know, it's subjective in a sense, but what would trigger that potentially would be a revision of a permit. If they were to somehow change their operation, even if they wanted to add 100 animal units or something, you know, unless there was some other exemption, or if they wanted to increase the amount of water, if they did some change in what they're now proposing, again, it would be a discretionary situation, but that generally would be the staff that you'd have to rely on to identify those situations and then to make an initial, you know, make some kind of a call, have a discussion about it perhaps, and make a call. But that ultimately could end up on your doorstep as a decision-making body.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, I have a question about the 12-mile pipeline. I know when crude oil pipeline is going to cross agricultural land, the proposer has to file a mitigation plan with the Department of Agriculture. And are they? Do they have regulatory oversight when it's a water pipeline that's being proposed here? Have they been called in on this?
Mr. Affeld or Mr. Peterson?
No, the only time that they have to require permits is when they're crossing, say, DNR land, or when they're operating in the right of way. They may have to get a permit from the county to install in the county right of way, or in the township right of way, or a state right of way if it was a state highway. In this case, they're not crossing a state highway, so they would not have to. If they're crossing private land, they do have to get an easement from the property owner. If they don't own it themselves, to do that pipeline. And my understanding is they've secured all the easements that they need to cross any private land that they'll be crossing.
What about a mitigation plan?
So the question was, the Department of Agriculture is required to be notified for crossing of agricultural land by a pipeline that carries oil.
For sure.
And so Mr. Riddle's question is, does that apply to a water main,
right,
basically?
Right.
Mr. Fear has volunteered to come forward with his understanding.
Right now, there's two permits that are submitted, one with the county to use the county road right-of-way. It's 12 miles of pipe, 7 miles is through private land, 5 is we'll use the road right-of-way, and we have a permit submitted to the county, and then we have a permit submitted for a DNR stream crossing. So those are the two permits that we have submitted.
And if I recall correctly, you're directionally boring?
Yep, the under the, crossing? You'll see the one, the stream crossing is directional boring,
and then we've agreed to directional bore any highways.
But there's some that crosses private agricultural land where,
yep,
you, then, where you dig a trench and
yep.
Cause, do you know that this is the Department of Ag requires a mitigation plan for pipelines? Because it's all to, you know, protect the productivity of that land to make sure that the topsoil is set aside, the subsoil, that the construction is done properly.
I would assume if I'm putting a pipeline on my land for water that I can, but I guess I don't know that.
No.
We'll
construction stormwater
we'll verify that requirement.
No.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the acreage.
Mr. Affeld, I'm sorry, before you leave, was there more that you were going to bring forward in the sort of your closing statements, or did you already do that?
No, well, I'll just very briefly do that. I was going to refer to the context of the decision within AQB rules.
Thank you.
My counsel may touch on that as well, but I want to just point out the three options as we see them at this point. Staff has made a recommendation for a negative declaration. We follow the criteria in EQB rules. It's 4410, 1700, subpart 7, which provided the four criteria that Mr. Peterson reviewed. We feel the evidence thus far still supports. The staff hasn't changed that recommendation. However, if you don't agree with that, or if there are other two options are in Subpart 2A of the same part, I believe, it's if there's insufficient information for you to make a decision today, you have two options basically that are outlined in the rule. You can order an EIS. You can make a positive declaration and see that as the best way to get the information that you are looking for. Or you can postpone the decision. That could be done for up to 30 days unless the RGU and the project proposer agree on some other time frames. So those are the three options that I just wanted to point those out and how those fit within the rule.
Thank you. Ms. Olson, did you have anything you wanted to add to that in terms of the board's decisions here today?
Thank you, Chair, board members. I would agree that that's essentially what the statute states. I'm going to go ahead and read Subdivision 2A because I don't think that you necessarily have a copy of it, and nor is it in the materials that you have. I will first point to in the findings of fact and order on page 2 on the proposed findings. That does outline subpart 7, which is your criteria. So that's in the materials before you. But Subdivision 2A says, if the RGU determines that information necessary to a reasoned decision about the potential for or significance of one or more possible environmental impacts is lacking, but could be reasonably obtained, the RGU shall either A, make a positive declaration and include within the scope of the EIS appropriate studies to obtain the lacking information, or B, postpone the decision on the need for an EIS for not more than 30 days or such other period of time as agreed upon by the RGU and proposer in order to obtain the lacking information. If the RGU postpones the decision, it shall provide written notice of its action, including a brief description of the lacking information within 5 days to the project proposer, the EQB staff, and any person who submitted substantive comments on the EAW.
Thank you. Before I move on to the board's pleasure, are there any other questions for the staff? Dr. Drager.
So, in the staff presentation, you did note one environmental study that you referred to. That was the Hancock Pro Pork EIS. That's close in proximity to these, which I imagine is why you listed it in your presentation. But what was it that triggered an EIS in that case that you are not requesting an EIS in this case?
Mr. Peterson.
That's an interesting case in that the EIS was actually a court-ordered EIS. I believe the PCA board made a negative declaration on the need for an EIS. The project was constructed. The PCA board was sued, and the judge ordered the PCA to do the EIS in that particular instance.
Thank you. So, board members, we have options for a decision. The staff recommendation is found on page 5 of the packet, where it makes a suggested staff resolution, which would be to order a negative declaration. We've also heard that other options are under subpart 2A of 4410-1700, subpart 7, that we could postpone a decision to gather additional data or require an EIS, make a positive declaration, and require additional data. So what's the board's pleasure?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, I move that we make a positive recommendation to require an EIS. I think there's the lack of the observation well data. I mean, that's serious to not have that 5 years of data of what's happening with water availability. Socioeconomic impacts clearly haven't been addressed. They're outside of the scope, but they would be part of the scope of an EIS. And then the fact that there are impaired waters in that watershed is something that needs further exploration as well. So that's my motion.
Mr. Jensen has seconded the motion. Is there further discussion on the matter? Ms. Drager? Dr. Drager? So I will ask Dr. Foley, and then I'm going to turn to Ms. Olson for some legal advice on how to structure an alternate resolution. Go ahead, Dr. Foley.
So if we vote for a positive declaration for an EIS, we then have to go through a statement of need and reasonableness, the whole process that maybe you can speak to, which would lay out all of the areas that we would expect the producer of the EIS, the agency to do, the staff, to bring us data on all of those factors. So there's another process that we would go through in order to scope the environmental impact statement document to hit all of the factors that we want to know.
So I
guess I would turn to our counsel for that.
Thank you, Dr. Foley. And Ms. Olson, please.
Thank you, Chair, Dr. Foley, and other board members. If you're going with the motion, which right now is to make a positive declaration, I want to point out that you would need to have RGU shall maintain a record, including specific findings of fact, supporting the decision to make a positive declaration. So a couple things. If you're going under subpart 2A, which is essentially you want more information, it's advisable that you talk about what exactly more information you want and what you're looking to find. Ideally, it would be most clear if you could set forth what your information is that you want. And then if you want a positive declaration, one option would be to direct the staff to return to the board with findings of fact to support the positive declaration based on the comments that you have. The other thing we could do is you could just walk through right now some of the findings of fact, but that would be a more arduous process.
Agreed. Dr. Drager.
Are we able to... So I just want to be clear because I know there's some legalese here that I'm maybe not, but can we vote on the motion that's before us?
Ms. Olson.
You could vote on the motion that's before you and then direct then decide what to do from there. But if you ended it with just a positive declaration without any findings of fact or other information in the record, then you would not have support or it'd be questionable if someone was to go up on appeal. So you would need to have either the information today in the record or to go forward on the positive declaration with the proposed findings of fact. So I guess at this juncture, I would advise that, I mean, there is a motion on the table. You can have further discussion of it, and you may want to discuss about what information you have or vote on the positive declaration and then discuss what information you believe is needed.
Mr. Riddle, I'd like maybe you raised three areas of needed information. Perhaps you could expound on that and then let the discussion flow in terms of what you find that would be a part of your recommendation for findings.
Sure. The three things I stated in making my motion, the lack of the observation well data, so just more information on the availability of water, especially with the impact of more irrigation wells being drilled in the last 5 years, so that's a big area. Socioeconomic impacts. Some of the commenters we heard about, roads and highway safety, land values, property values, people leaving the area due to, impact on their quality of life. So those would be some socioeconomic. The impaired waters, the fact that the proposer does not have lined up adequate acres to spread this manure, I think is certainly a factor that needs more exploration. It can't just be a promise that we hope to sell that excess manure and then it becomes unregulated. So knowing exactly what's going to happen with the manure. Some of the health impacts that have been brought up, the cumulative impacts of hydrogen sulfide exposure, especially children with asthma, looking into some of the health impacts and hopefully something beyond modeling, some actual monitoring of similar facilities and air quality experiences in other confined animal feeding operations. And then the issue about the need for a pipeline permit from the Department of Ag, I think that should be explored if a mitigation plan needs to be filed or not. Does it fall under the same requirements as other types of pipelines?
Thank you, Mr. Riddle. Are there other comments or concerns board members want to offer? Dr. Drager.
So just two that I had mentioned earlier about whether climate modeling, and I did appreciate that we did get some information on that, but that it has been changing rapidly over the last couple of years, those numbers of what it is that constitutes those kind of extreme rainfall events. So the addition of how extreme weather events, and also I would be, interested in if there's any issue associated with the increase in pattern tiling.
Dr. Foley.
Yeah, I would like some information on the cumulative impacts of the other concentrated animal feedlot operations that are not just at 3 miles, but there just is a major concentration of animal feedlot activities in that whole area, as demonstrated by your permitted feedlots. So any cumulative effects, health effects related to those concentrated operations.
Mr. Ibarra.
One of the things that I need to get clear in my mind, when we were discussing the eutrophication issue a couple of months ago, one of the things that we were warned of is making a decision in staff council, what we could use as information to make this decision on. Staff made a recommendation that we support this, or that I would be inclined to support based on staff recommendation. And I want to say to the proposers, thank you for your candor and your honesty when you were up here. I appreciate some of the things that came up. I appreciate, that didn't necessarily shed a positive light on what some of the things that have happened, but appreciate the fact that you were honest about it. Thanks to the testifiers for coming in and bringing forth the message that they brought. I think the one thing that I really find challenging is the first issue that Board Member Riddle raised was in regards to the lack of well data and the fact that, you know, this the initial permit was issued 5 years ago based on data 5 years ago, and with all of the unauthorized wells, irrigation wells that have been drilled, I'll be curious to find out if that data is still consistent with what was found 5 years ago. I would think based on some of the comments that were made by the proposers that having an adequate water supply is just as important to them as it is to the constituents that are going to be impacted, the private citizens that potentially are impacted as well. So thank you.
Dr. Drager.
I would just like to second what Mr. Barr said, is that I thought the proposers did respond to all these questions with great candor. I understand more about their operations, so I appreciate that there was a very good deal of both public and staff testimony today. That was
helpful. Board members, let me just comment on the framing of our resolution here. For the sake there, I want to offer two alternatives. One is, if we need findings of fact and we need some documentation to support the board's decision, if we go down the path of this resolution, one option we have is to send the staff away with our attorneys to write something right now, before we leave the table today, and come back with some findings that can be written down and can be reviewed and acted upon by the board today. That's one alternative. I think it's preferable that we get something in writing before we leave here. Secondly, another alternative, and I will put this out there, is given that we have these areas that we wish for more information about, the other provision under the rule is that we simply ask for additional information from the project proponent under the current timeline for the EAW and negotiate a timeline to bring that information back to the board and then make a decision about the need for an EIS. That's an alternative that I'd offer, just that would carry with it another set of findings that would have to be made. But they both rely on some written material that will have to be generated by our staff. And so I'm looking just for your preference. We've got a motion on the table. I offer that just from the sake of additional thought to consider before we vote. Any other thoughts or comments on the motion before us?
Well, I'll just speak in favor of my motion. And I also really appreciate what you said, Mr. Ibarra, and the proposers as well as the commenters. But we've learned that not all of Riverview's facilities even have an EAW that are operating with up to 10,000 animal units, or close to that, or around that number. And, you know, to me, it seems like it's time that an EIS be completed, that it warrants that. The cumulative effect, I mean, that's a huge operation. They already have two permits issued for facilities they haven't built that could be built at any time, and they're increasing animal unit numbers under that 1,000 per 3 years. And so I think, given the significance of not just this project but their overall operation and its impact on the entire culture of that region as well as the environment, that an EIS is warranted at this time.
Thank you. So, we could, I'm just looking to my parliamentarian to my left, regarding the motion that's on the table. Ms. Olson, am I understanding correctly? One option is we vote on the motion, and the findings of fact are directed to be written, or do we have to have the findings of fact before us before we take the vote. If we were to do that, do we have to amend the motion to allow that to occur? What can you advise on that, please?
I would recommend that you amend the motion to direct that findings of fact be prepared and then approve the final findings of fact and the final motion if that's what you decide to do.
Dr. Foley.
Written today.
That is correct.
Voting now.
But voting now, if I amend my motion to direct that findings of fact be written according to the various issues that have been raised by board members, correct?
Ms. Olson.
Correct.
Okay.
That would be my recommendation that you would direct.
I'm sorry. My recommendation based that you would direct that based on the comments that you have about the environmental impacts that you've discussed during the period here, be incorporated into findings of fact to support if you vote positively for a positive declaration.
Okay. Well, I will amend my motion to reflect that.
Mr. Riddle amends his motion to direct the staff to develop findings toward the issuance of a positive declaration on the matter based on the comments previously made. Mr. Jensen? Concurs in a second. Now, board members, the matter before us is the amended motion, which is to direct the staff to develop findings in support of a positive declaration. Our expectation is that we would bring the next decision item up before us immediately and send the staff away to work on that at present, and that we would then come back today. Is that the board's pleasure? I'm seeing nods of heads. So, on the motion before us, directing staff to develop the findings for positive declaration. Let me get to my roll call. Mr. Ibarra.
Aye.
Dr. Sampson is absent. Dr. Drager.
Aye.
Dr. Foley.
Aye.
Ms. Hang is absent. Mr. Jensen.
Aye.
Mr. Riddle.
Aye.
And the chair votes no. There are five affirmative, one against. The motion passes. So, staff, and do we have legal support? All right, so we will see you in a not too distant future. On the next decision item, let's take a short break to allow people to use the facilities and transition to our next team of presenters. We are recessed for 5 minutes.